Here's where you can find out more about financial exploitation of the elderly. Welcome to our Brain Science and the Law podcast for January-February 2011 on financial exploitation and undue influence. This is Dr. Valerie Stone from Answers About Competency, LLC. Today, I'll be talking with Dr. David Mirich, a psychologist in practice in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. First, we'll talk briefly about Dave's background, then talk about how psychologists go about detecting vulnerability to exploitation in seniors with diminished capacity, and finally, we'll talk about undue influence over adults whose mental capacity is fine, but who end up in abusive situations. So thanks for joining us today, David. Can you tell us a little about your background?
Yes, I was a former school teacher in the public school system, and then later became a school psychologist, received my PhD at University of Denver, and then began private practice.
And what do you do at your, you've got a psychology assessment, treatment, and health center. Tell us a little bit about PATHS Center.
Right. We've definitely evolved over the years, specializing in different areas as time has gone on. Many evaluations with pilots, that's a new area of mine these last 4 years, airline pilots who for some reason have been referred for comprehensive neuropsychological evaluation by the FAA. I have also specialized in the area of neuropsychological assessments for people with traumatic brain injuries or oftentimes questions involving capacity, competence, legal competence.
We're going to be talking about undue influence and financial abuse today. And there's a couple of different situations this can happen in. One is where someone, often a senior, though not always, it could happen in a younger person with brain difficulties, but someone has a neurological condition like Alzheimer's or brain injury that reduces their mental capacity and makes them more vulnerable to exploitation. Another situation where undue influence can happen is when the person being influenced has perfectly normal mental capacity but ends up in an abusive situation. So let's talk about reduced mental capacity first. How do you do assessments in these cases, Dave?
Right. As you said, there's all sorts of different presentations in these types of cases, and they're not always involving elderly, but sometimes may involve someone with brain injury or a developmentally disabled individual. The most recent one I did was with a man in his early mid-50s who had possibly a traumatic brain injury from a motorcycle accident 30 years before, but definitely had what appeared to be a dementia caused by alcohol abuse and dependence. And we determined him to be suffering from dementia, and B, that he did not meet the statutory requirements for capacity, and so he was appointed a guardian to take care of his, and a conservator actually, to take care of his financial issues.
So what kinds of things do you do in an assessment? What kinds of measures do you take?
Right. Well, let's just take this case for example. This individual was, although quite verbally fluent, could understand and answer most any question that I had for him. However, testing was quite difficult because he was very impulsive. The executive centers of functioning of his brain had been so damaged by the alcohol abuse that he was quite unable to stay focused, and so testing was quite difficult to keep redirecting him. Several tests he would simply give up and say that he didn't understand, wasn't willing, frankly, to continue testing. So we had to make certain determinations based on incomplete testing, etc. But we would first start out with the attempting to give the traditional battery of tests that you often see in any neuropsychological report, the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scales, third edition, now the fourth edition. We begin with things such as that, an IQ, comprehensive intellectual quotient, IQ battery, and followed by many different types of tests that could get at visual abstract reasoning, to look at motor control, and just to try and see if there's maybe some certain areas of the brain that have been impaired more than others. And we'll begin with that, and then we then go from the traditional neuropsychological battery into specific test instruments that help us look at testamentary capacity, financial decision-making, that help us get at medical decision-making abilities and this type of thing. Also, we'll give the family members or caretakers some of these same checklists and instruments that would help us to look at processing ability, their, let's say, caretaker burden of what they have to do to help this person to get by day to day, their limitations and functionality, etc.
I'm really glad to hear you do that, because it's really important to remember some of the limitations of sort of standard neuropsych tests when you have to address functioning in the real world. The real world is, of course, a lot more complicated than a neuropsych testing room.
That's right.
And in fact, being scammed or exploited financially could be an early warning sign of dementia.
Well, that's right.
This is something I've looked at in some of my research in developing the social vulnerability scale, which looks at people's tendency to fall for scams or exploitation. We found that people with dementia were much more likely than people without dementia to be scammed or exploited. And furthermore, we think that it may really be an early warning sign that even while some neuropsych tests are fine, that someone might still have trouble in these kinds of complex decision-making situations that involve financial decisions. So can you talk about some of the more interesting cases you've seen where someone with diminished mental capacity has been exploited?
Yes, I'd be glad to, and I definitely agree that many of our traditional neuropsychological test evaluation assessments, reports that come across my desk from other psychologists here locally, I often find that, yes, I agree with you, that they do seem to maybe focus more on traditional measurements that don't necessarily help us to accurately determine whether or not the elderly person that we're evaluating has some real-world limitations and difficulties that would point to some of the what you mentioned would be signs of early signs of dementia. So I'm often taken by that when I read these other reports that, well, okay, it, just because this elderly person was able to perform well or adequately on certain of these traditional batteries, that doesn't give me the information I need, because, frankly, when I research the case and I look at the referral questions and potentially interview people who know the individual and can tell me all about their actual behaviors, these behaviors are incongruent with good performance on testing. So that tells me that the testing doesn't capture all of what we're witnessing here with this person's behavior on a day-to-day basis. So what I do in these cases, in all cases, frankly, with people who are referred to me for these types of capacity evaluations, I'm going to give other more non-traditional and, let's say, ambiguous forms of assessment that can help me to really assess a little more accurately this person's cognitive ability, particularly in the frontal region, in the areas of executive functioning. So some of these tests may include, for example, say that there's several that I like to employ, the alternate uses test, where you ask them to tell you all of the common uses for a certain object, let's say a brick or a pencil, and then you ask them to give you as many as they can uncommon uses for these same objects. A person with some real frontal limitations of executive processes will have great difficulty with these types of things which would be quite simple for most anyone else. Whereas when you rely on traditional neuropsychological testing, such as, let's just say, some tests such as the Wisconsin card sorting test that purports to really get at executive functioning, or the category test from the old Halstead Raytan battery. These tests, oftentimes I'm finding that my elderly clients can negotiate the demands of these highly structured tests, yet their behavior, day-to-day life, belies the results of these tests. So that's why I...
So when life doesn't provide structure, sorry to interrupt.
Exactly.
When life doesn't provide structure, then they struggle a bit more.
That's
so
precisely...
So you look for these other tests.
That's precisely the point. When provided complete structured existence, yes, let's say that they may look as if they're able to function in a way that's adequate. Whereas, yes, once things become a bit unstable, let's say a change in caretaker, a change in residence, a change in health, a change, social changes, a change in medical professionals working with the individual, these types of things can be highly unsettling, and the lack of that structure then will show itself in the inability to make... to employ the decision-making process in a way that would keep the individual safe and protected.
So tell me about some of the more interesting cases you've seen where someone with diminished mental capacity has been exploited.
Well, I know I was recently sent a case by Adult Protection Services here locally of a woman who, by all accounts, appeared to be fairly normally functioning, who was highly verbally proficient. She was actually elderly, 84 years old, and was able to get past all my neuropsychological testing with a little problem. She looked quite normal in most ways. However, the evidence that we had that, again, belied the results of my testing was that she was... had given away, oh, I think it was $100,000 total to two different individuals who had sweepstakes scams, one from England and the other fellow was in Canada. And what was interesting about this case was that, again, yes, she performed pretty well on the traditional testing, yet here she was, frankly, evidencing a good deal of delusional thought and just distortions in thinking that these men were on her side, that they cared about her, they called her constantly, and they developed this type of relationship of dependence of some type. And let's assume, too, that she was somewhat isolated now in her older years and was dependent on these men to... be her friend, I guess, and yes, but so the evidence was that she was, and frankly, even after she had spent most all of her money, giving these men these large sums of money with the hopes of winning a sweepstakes, that she still was telling me that I'm going to win. If I just get $5,000 more, I'm going to win the sweepstakes.
So there's some, beyond the standard psych testing, some real-world evidence from her everyday functioning of the kind of decision-making impairment she had.
Absolutely. This behavior was completely incongruent with the good test results from the neuropsychological battery. So that's, again, a case where I want to go forward with more of these other ambiguous tests of frontal activity. And sure enough, those tests did show that there is an impairment, which points to early signs of dementia. Now, I do know that a lot of, I'm no attorney, but I do know that there is some case law that says that even though someone does have these early signs of dementia, that doesn't by definition mean that they have diminished mental capacity. However, we definitely want to educate the court about the true nature of this case. Maybe another evaluator would have said, well, this person did quite well on testing, therefore maybe she has the right to give her money away to whoever she wants. Whereas myself, I didn't agree with that.
I think that's a great point to bring out, because there are lots of other tests that get specifically at financial decision-making ability,
right,
as you mentioned, that get at medical decision-making ability, and just some more ambiguous tests, like you mentioned, the alternate uses test. There's a couple of other ones out there to get at more subtle frontal lobe functions. And we want to encourage attorneys and courts to make sure that they get that kind of information that goes beyond standard tests. And we want to encourage psychologists to use those tests more widely in their practice.
Absolutely.
Now, of course, someone can have reduced capacity for some kinds of decisions, like complex financial decisions, but still have preserved capacity to make other kinds of decisions, like maybe some healthcare decisions.
Right.
So can you talk about some of the most interesting cases like these that you've seen?
Yes, and certainly this is a very complex field of practice, the business of capacity and the different forms of capacity. And, of course, I think that people who work in this field understand, including attorneys, that just because someone is clearly incapacitated in a certain area, let's say they have no idea how much money they have or where it is or whether or not they're being manipulated or their money's being taken illegally by someone, that doesn't mean necessarily that this person doesn't have a good idea about or an adequate understanding of their health issues, the medicines they take, the types of the appointments they need to keep, etc., and have shown a capacity to still manage and make decisions for themselves regarding, let's say, the medical piece. Oh, and you were asking an interesting case that I might speak about. Well, this definitely gets quite interesting at times, because although some of these may be more clear-cut than others and quite easy to defend, to determine and defend, other cases can be very difficult. And I'm thinking right now of a couple different cases that I've had where the individual was, well, here's one where this elderly fellow had a great deal of brain damage from dementia and other health issues, diabetes, etc. And he was basically nonverbal in a wheelchair and could really only communicate by nodding his head a little bit and use of his eyes to communicate. And this was quite a difficult case, because he was communicating to hospital staff, to his nursing home staff, that he didn't want to have the feeding tube keeping him alive any longer. That he was, and they brought me in to see if I could determine whether or not he actually had the capacity to make this decision. That was quite a difficult case for me. I certainly had to read extensively on the nature of this type of case and consult with my colleagues that were familiar with this type of thing. I spent quite a lot of time with him, with the hospital staff, with the hospital records. It was really an agonizing experience in many ways for me, because in the end, it did turn out that I determined that he didn't have the capacity to make any financial or frankly even medical decisions. However, I did determine that he was exhibiting the threshold necessary to determine that he had the right to make his end-of-life decision for himself.
So he understood the choice he was making and what the consequences would be.
Absolutely, and that took a great deal of research and investigation and documentation in order for when this went in front of a probate court that I was able to defend my determinations.
I'll just emphasize here that it is best for someone to make out a living will or advance medical directive while they still have full capacity, so that situations like this are avoided, so that medical professionals know ahead of time what the person wants.
It would have saved a lot of heartache for a lot of people.
There is a nonprofit organization, Compassion and Choices, that gives people good information about end-of-life decisions. I've got a couple of websites, compassionandchoices.org and another local chapter here in Colorado, choicesboulder.org. Also, the Guardianship Alliance of Colorado has good information about advanced medical directives. That's just guardianshipallianceofcolorado.org. So let's turn to cases of undue influence in which someone has perfectly intact mental capacity, but ends up in an abusive situation anyway.
Quite common.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. This unfortunately, with this aging population, is occurring more and more often. You'll have quite a number of individuals these days who are, they've not suffered any deficiencies, any impairments cognitively, even with the normal process of aging. They're still quite sharp. There's no measurable differences in before and after. Yet, the person is, let's say, non-ambulatory now because of health issues or just because of aging, and is more and more isolated for various reasons, physical and other reasons. And then you, let's say, have individuals who have nefarious motivations for keeping this person isolated and dependent, creating a dependence. And then this normally functioning elderly person is suddenly making decisions that they wouldn't have normally made.
So this sounds like a very abusive situation.
Yes, it's unfortunately, we have seen plenty of this where the elderly person, by all accounts and through evaluation, is normally functioning, yet is definitely susceptible to abuse, is susceptible to undue influence, and is making really bad decisions with their money.
So how does the, let's call this person the perpetrator in this case, how do they manipulate the person who's dependent on them?
Frankly, I'd love to just say that, oh, well, these are disturbed people and psychopaths who this is what they do. They prey on elderly people, and that's why you have what you have. However, sadly, there are plenty of normally functioning people who are not psychopathic and who just simply feel, for whatever reasons, entitled to that person's money. They somehow rationalize it in their mind that, hey, I deserve this. The old person doesn't need all this money. It won't hurt them to, if I cut myself loose with a little bit, they're not paying me enough anyway. I work so hard. For whatever reasons, they justify it.
Is it ever family members who do this?
Well, typically would be family members and or people who are very close to the individual. But one thing is certain, that if a person does have that type of motivation to take this person's money against that person's knowledge or will, that they understand somewhere inside that they probably better keep this on the down low as much as possible. And the best way to do that is by not allowing this person to communicate with others. And so to isolate this person, to screen their phone calls, to not take them to certain people's houses because they, let's say, they demonize this person. Oh, your son, he's just after your money. He's a bad person. We're not going to go over there anymore. They figure out ways to isolate the individual and then create a dependence.
So that sounds like it actually has a lot in common with spousal abuse.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, I've often said that. This can happen even with a younger, normally functioning individual who is not necessarily susceptible in the same way as an elderly person. This absolutely has a lot of overlap with spousal abuse. We see the same thing there, oftentimes with the spousal abuse perpetrator isolating the wife, not allowing her to have friendships, being overly controlling with controlling all the money issues, controlling when and where they go places and do things, possibly even oftentimes using physical abuse, but certainly verbal abuse and other verbal means of control.
How do you go about investigating such a case as a psychologist? What kinds of evidence do you look for when you're doing an investigation?
Right, and this is oftentimes the toughest part of the job, because I think that it's quite easy just to sit in your office and whip together a report for the court and feel that you've done an adequate job. Whereas, frankly, it's in these types of cases, it's only half of the story, if that. What I find is that I oftentimes the testing and the interview with the client, it doesn't necessarily give me much. That what I really need to do is look into the collateral information. Of course, you know, everyone is going to want to examine the medical records in depth, I would hope. But even then, it's usually best to go ahead and contact one of the medical professionals or several of them who have been involved with the individual. It's surprising how much information they have that they never put into the medical records. They have opinions. They have observations on family members and their motivations. It's, yes, I often feel like I'm a detective as I'm moving through the case. I certainly want to maybe even look at the person's home. In a few cases, that has really given me a tremendous amount of information to walk through their home and just examine and make my observations of how they live their life, how they're being taken care of. Is there food in the cabinets? Is the place in total disarray? Are the caretakers apparently not caretaking very well? That gives me a good deal of information.
And how important is it to talk to other people in the abused person's social circle?
Right. Well, obviously, that's, you know, much of this other half that I was just talking about. Without that, I don't feel I've done an adequate job. I recently testified in a probate case regarding undue influence where I interviewed 15 people because this was a very complex issue, and I wanted to get a thorough knowledge of the person who is being accused of undue influence and her relationship with her now deceased husband. So I spoke to three different medical doctors. Again, they had excellent observations of family interactions and family dynamics and family motivations. I spoke with many old friends who, again, sometimes you'll find that someone may be more isolated than they were in the past, either because of physical limitations or because the spouse, caretaker, family member is intentionally isolating them. So to talk to old friends certainly gives a great deal of information about their take on this individual, his capacity to advocate for himself, their observations of why this person is now more isolated than before. Interestingly, in this case I'm thinking about, the wife was accused of isolating the husband in his last few years where he was dying of cancer, and there was some persuasive testimony that she had cut certain people, old friends, out of his life. But as I interviewed many, many other old friends, they said that, hey, these two guys weren't necessarily even all that close of friends, that they were more business associates and that they weren't necessarily cut out of his life. He didn't really want to see them. So there's always another side to the story oftentimes that if you don't look into it a little further, you may get sideswiped by some testimony that isn't necessarily correct.
So you really need very rich detail about the social context that the person is in to figure out whether this is a case where the person is being manipulated and isolated.
Right, because, and it goes both ways. If just because there's accusations of undue influence doesn't necessarily mean that's going to play out in the end once you investigate. And as a psychologist, you'd think my job would be a little bit different in this regard, but no, it does become a thing of being quite the investigator. And then on the other hand, you'll have plenty of cases where there is a great deal of evidence that's persuasive and very conclusive that this individual has been isolated, has been manipulated with or without diminished capacity.
Now, if we think about the definition, the legal definition of undue influence and using someone, doing harm to another person by using their financial resources for your own gain, how do abusers or manipulators try to justify that?
Well, right. Again, I think that there are plenty of people who do have, let's say, a psychopathic personality. That is to say that although that's not in our DSM-4 as a diagnosis, psychopathic personality, what we're talking about when we say that is somebody that has very little empathy, has no remorse, can easily move in and out of people's lives and manipulate them and leave them in complete ruins and not have any compassion or regret or remorse. But these types of personalities are oftentimes found living off of people, such as the elderly. I think that there's a great number of these psychopathic personalities that simply cannot make a living in the real world. They fly off the handle, they feel entitled, they yell at their boss, they can't keep a job. And so they figure out ways to get by in life. And what easier target than an old person who's lonely and is easily manipulated, say, some of them, and that they find this to be a way of life. And that, but again, that's not necessarily all or even most of the perpetrators that we see that are taking advantage of the elderly. Again, it usually comes down to family members, caretakers who are just possibly ne'er-do-well, not necessarily a bad person, but it's just so tempting to cozy up to this old person who showers them with gifts and lets them drive their car and lets them stay at their home or whatever it is, that this person can then begin to see this as a really nice ride and want to hang on to it as long as possible. And again, it just seems like the best way for many of these perpetrators to do this kind of action is by progressively making the individual more and more isolated and more dependent on him or her. And I even have recently saw a case where there was an individual who had some very elderly parents that were quite wealthy, and they had 7 children. Well, the 6 brothers and sisters were quite upset to find out that one received all of the inheritance, and they were all cut out. One was a ne'er-do-well. He didn't like to work. He just kind of hung around with his parents and ran them to the store after they lost their driver's licenses in their older years. He would run them around and go get them food and take them here and there, and he pretty much was just always present. So somehow, behind the scenes, he convinced them that all of his brothers and sisters didn't care, didn't deserve anything, were all set up and didn't need anything, but that he, on the other hand, had sacrificed and was deserving of the entire inheritance.
It is important to respect the wishes of someone who does have mental capacity who has not been subject to undue influence in a case like that.
Correct. There's no doubt that this kind of case, although on the surface might seem to us to be unseemly and maybe not the best decision for these people, they were absolutely within their rights. They both had capacity to make such decisions. Whether it was not proven in this case that there was any undue influence. So that's what the court determined. And a tough case. I think that many of these cases could easily go either way. I think that depending on the skills of the attorney and the strength of the work of the psychologist on the case, on either side of the case, these types of cases often go either way. And I think that, in fact, we don't even see a fraction of this very type of case because no one ever brings a suit.
That's true. Another interesting aspect of this is the fact that, in a sense, you're being called in a case like this where a will is contested. The person has already died. You can't do a capacity assessment directly on the person who did the will. So you're, in a sense, having to determine capacity retroactively.
Correct, yes. I recently did a big case like that where that was the one I was mentioning earlier where I interviewed 15 people. Normally, I wouldn't have to interview that many people, but because the person in question was deceased, it made it necessary to really look into the background of this individual. But yes, piecing this together post-mortem was quite the experience, and it definitely brought out all of my best skills.
Well, thanks very much for sharing this information, David, because I've obviously talked and written a lot about what happens in cases of diminished capacity, but the fact that undue influence can happen even in cases where there's not diminished capacity, where the person is fine, but there is some kind of abuse and manipulation going on, is a really important one to raise awareness of. So thanks very much for talking to me today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Now, I think we should also probably give your contact details. Can you give us your phone number and your website?
Yeah, certainly. My name, Dr. David Mirich, M-I-R-I-C-H, and I'm at 303-824-0132. I'm located in Wheat Ridge, and you can find me on www.pathscenter.com. That is PATHScenter.com.
You can find out more about exploitation of seniors with diminished capacity on my website, www.assesscompetency.com. Last April's podcast was focused on this issue. Thanks for listening to this Brain Science and the Law podcast. Information in this podcast is up to date as of January 2011. For more information about capacity, competency, and CLE workshops that I offer, check my website, www.assesscompetency.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you in our next podcast about pediatric brain injury and controversies over the medical evidence for shaken baby syndrome.